Each week, American History TV sits in on a lecture with one of the nation's college professors. You can watch the classes here every Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. Next, history professor John Thomas Scott discusses the American colonial resistance movement that evolved into the American Revolution. Professor Scott examines the growing tensions between Britain and the American colonies in late 1760s and early 1770s, as Britain attempted to retain control of the colonies. This class took place at Mercer University in Macon, Georgia.
Okay, so we are looking at the period, the early revolutionary period. We talked about how last time, when you look at the revolutionary era, that historians typically start at sometime around 1763 and end at 1783. But that the call of that, the revolutionary era, is anachronistic, because for at least the first decade or so, until about 74, 75, that what we are really dealing with is a resistance movement that nobody, certainly not before about 74, is talking about revolution. It's a resistance movement. So in last class and this class, what we're really talking about is the beginning of a resistance movement in that period. And today we want to break out the period between 65 and 70 and look at it in more detail. So that's our main goal today. Let me preface this, though, by saying you and I live in a world where resistance or protest movements, opposition to governmental action, is all very normal. And we take it to be simply part of life. So we have Occupy Wall Street. We've got the Tea Party movement going on. We have protests about the Trayvon Martin case. We live in a world where public protests are normal and natural. They didn't live in a world where public protests, where resistance to governmental action was normal or natural. They lived in a world where resistance to governmental actions, protests, were dangerous, right? Where you took some risk to your fortune, to your body, to your body politic, right? By involving yourself in some sort of governmental protest or resistance movement. All right. So we partly have to put our heads back in their minds of thinking, really sort of seeing this, how new, how uncertain they were about what they were doing. Again, today we have, if something happens and we want to have a protest movement, we have any number of examples to turn to and say, okay, well, we should do this, and we already do that, and then we'll do this thing, and then we'll do that thing. Right? So it's for us today, protests are all very sort of patterned, right, and normal. For them, it was not. But here's the curious thing. Only in retrospect can you and I look back and realize that what they were doing between about 65 and 75, what they were doing was actually creating a template of public protest and public resistance that American culture has followed pretty much ever since. Now, they don't know that. They aren't sitting around thinking, hey, let's come up with a protest template so people can use it for the next couple hundred years. But in fact, that's what they ended up doing. They wandered into, right, a kind of mechanism or mechanisms to protest governmental actions or protest something they didn't like, that Americans ever since then, and to some extent, people around the world ever since have picked up. Right? So if you looked at what went on in the Arab Spring last year in Egypt, what's going on in Syria right now, and in other locations around the globe, many of those follow very similar patterns, same kinds of structures. In some cases, as in America, those move over into revolution. A government is removed and a new government gets instituted. In some cases, that doesn't happen. The protest movement is able to make change without an actual change in government or a change in the leadership patterns. Some cases, this case, as it played out, that became necessary. So sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. So if we look at what we've been looking at, right? So when we think about then the emergence of public protests as ways of resolving opposition to governmental actions, when we look at this period, we started last time with background and just to remind you briefly that we read about how there had been in the colonial period a practice of resistance. That there had been several issues which had prompted at least some level of public resistance. So that when you get to 65, the colonies, the colonists, are not totally new to the practice of resistance. And we talked about how some of that resistance revolved around the customs office, collection of taxes. Some of that revolved around impressment. This is the taking of typically sailors, people in seaports, and pressing them, drafting them into the Royal Navy. And we looked at a specific piece of legislation, the White Pine Act. Right. So that there was, right, at least some level of practice to resistance prior to the Revolutionary Era. Right? We also talked about how there was an ideology of resistance that was present in the colonies. That there was a set of ideas that had been developed actually in Britain, but transported across the Atlantic over the course of the 18th century, which provided a certain level of ideological or intellectual legitimacy to resisting governmental actions. Pauline Meyer, who's the author of the book we're reading, she identifies those, others have, as the Whigs or the real Whigs. Right? Not the half-baked Whigs, but these are the real Whigs. And these are the folks that pointed to their, right, the event that they pointed to as their sort of model of resistance was the Glorious Revolution back in the late 17th century in England. All right. So last time we looked at the background to resistance. And Meyer pointed out that there was both the practice of resistance in the colonial era, and there was also an ideology of resistance. So that the colonists were what another historian labeled Bernard Bailyn, who I mentioned last time. Bailyn argued that the colonists were actually latently revolutionary by the middle of the century, right? So something that's latent. I've got some scientists or engineers in here. You'll know that latent means that it's capable of becoming active, but it's not active at that moment. There has to be something else added to that, right, to make this chemical or this mixture actually have energy in it, right? And so that's the picture here, that the colonies, because of this practice and because of this ideology, that they are latently revolutionary. Okay, so background. Let me see, any questions about that? Okay. Next thing I want to turn to, right, we move into the period, is really look at the dynamic what I would describe as the dynamic of resistance. And there's a fairly clear dynamic of resistance that emerges in the period right after 1765 that actually carries through right up into the Revolution. And when we get to the Revolution, we get to independence, we'll look at how the cycle gets broken. But there's a fairly clear dynamic of resistance that started in almost every case, pretty much in every case, with some sort of British action. Most commonly a legislative action, although in some cases there were other kinds of actions. Well, that's important, of course, to this whole notion of resistance, because if there's no action, there's nothing to resist. Another way of thinking about it is, this is not a situation where the colonists had some extra time one Thursday afternoon, and they were sitting around drinking tea, and said, you know, we just ought to start resisting something. We don't really know what, but we should just start resisting. No, in fact, the colonists were, in 1763, quite laudatory of the British system. It was these British activities, or British actions, that pushed them in. So the first wave of actions or activities comes in this period between 1763 and 1765. Right? And they're generally grouped under the name the Grenville Program, after the British Prime Minister of the time, George Grenville. One E, not Greenville, Grenville. The Grenville Ministry at 1763 had a couple of problems that it was trying to address. One was that it was the British government was suffering under tremendous debt as a result of those Anglo-French wars, specifically the French and Indian War that had ended in 1763. Like the United States in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, we've incurred a tremendous amount of debt from those wars. We did in World War II, right? We accrue a tremendous amount of debt. And there's a move to, at the end of the French and Indian War, there's a move to try to address that debt in some way. The British were worried about this debt sort of overhanging them, and that it might cripple them in such a way that when the next French war came, and almost everyone was convinced there would be another French war, that Britain would not be able to respond. So one of the things that the British government was trying to address in the Grenville Acts, was revenue. They were trying to find additional sources of revenue. All right. So for instance, you get the passage in 1764 of the revenue, or it's sometimes called the Sugar Act, as a way of augmenting revenue coming out of the colonies. Right. And the one that we'll turn to in more detail, the one that is best known, is this 1765 Stamp Act. So there's effort at gaining revenue from the colonies. There was also, as part of the Grenville program, an idea of tightening up control, administrative control, or regulatory control of the colonies. As early as the late 1740s, many in Britain had begun to feel that the colonies were getting out of control a little bit, that they were not fulfilling their role as a colonial or even a provincial partner in the empire, that there was too much smuggling going on, that they had not properly supported Britain in its war efforts in King George's War, in the French and Indian War, and that a number of policies needed to be adopted or adapted in order to bring the colonies more tightly under control. Now, not a sense of iron grip, okay? So this is, there's not this reaction. Grenville Probe is not see the colonies and try to place some giant iron grip on it. The sense that certain elements of the colonial practice need to be cleaned up, need to be straightened up, need to be better organized. So, for instance, Parliament passed something called the Quartering Act, 1765. The Quartering Act required colonies to provide quarters, lodging, for British troops when British troops were in colonial settings. This had been a problem during the French and Indian War. Colonies, cities within the colonies, had often refused to provide housing for soldiers who were in the colonies to protect the colonies from the French. To the British, it seemed quite reasonable, natural, that the colonies, in fact, should provide quarters, lodging, for soldiers in the colonies there to protect the colonists from the French. So you get the Quartering Act is one of the things. Another thing done in this time period and is the Proclamation of 1763. Now here's an example of a piece of governmental policy that was not part of any sort of coherent program, but was put forward in the context of these other things, and in the colonial mind just gets lumped in with these kinds of acts. So at the end of the French and Indian War, there had been a broad Indian uprising in the West. It became known as Pontiac's Rebellion. The British did not desire to invest or expend a lot more economic resources putting down an Indian revolt or rebellion in the West. Rather, they looked for an option to remove the chief irritant in the West, which was American settlers cresting the Appalachians, moving into the Ohio River, Tennessee River valleys. So Britain, in one fell swoop in 1763, simply makes a proclamation that no settlers, no land, can be legally sold west of the crest of the Appalachians. In other words, colonists cannot legally move west of the Appalachian Mountains. The idea is you remove the irritant, you'll remove the rebellion. That'll be a lot cheaper than sending troops out into the Ohio River Valley, putting down the rebellion. Now, there were some troops sent, but the proclamation was part of a strategy, part of a plan to try to better control, in this instance, better control colonial movement, colonial migration. Again, not so much part of a coherent or well thought out plan, but something brought along trying to keep the colonies somewhat more tightly under British control and regulate their movement and their behavior. Okay, so there were some other things passed too, but these are some examples. Revenue and regulation. All right. Increase revenue in order to alleviate Britain's debt problem. Regulate certain aspects of colonial life. Let me give you one other on the regulation, an important one. I'll come up here. The Currency Act. It's another important one aimed at regulation. The colonies over the course of the 18th century had been in an ongoing hard money deficit. For a variety of reasons connected to the mercantilistic system, not much specie, hard money, coins, gold and silver coins, flowed into the colonies, tended to flow out. It meant that there was always a money shortage in the colonies in the 18th century. The colonies had often gotten around that by printing paper money, printing paper currency. So you had Connecticut money, New York money, Virginia money, Rhode Island money. Each colony would print its own money, would declare that money to be legal tender for payments within the colony. Right? Sometimes would use that money to pay Britain the tax revenues that are being required by the British government. And what the colonies found out was that printing money was often a much less expensive and also less upsetting to the populace than actually taxing money or taxing for money. The result had been in several of the colonies inflation to the point where the colonial currency was not worth much. And when you returned to London carrying a piece of colonial currency, it was worth almost nothing in some cases. Britain said, enough of that, right? And put restrictions on the kinds and the amounts of currency that could be that could be printed in the colonies. Right? Again, trying to regularize colonial activity. That's the British action, right? The Grenville Program and some of these other elements added to it. Right? The American reaction came in 65 and 66. There had been a few grumblings in 63 and 64, but it was really 65 and 66, generally labeled the Stamp Act. That was the act, Stamp Act crisis. How it quickly got dubbed the Stamp Act crisis in 65 and 66. The Stamp Act passed in the spring of 65 by Parliament. It was to go in effect in November 1, 65. That was the act that really emerged the American resistance movement around the Stamp Act. We'll talk about the elements of the Stamp Act, why they were opposed to that in a bit. All right. This is the American reaction. Right? So British action, an American reaction. And then a British response. A British response. In the first two cycles, the ones that we're going to look at today, the Stamp Act crisis and then the Townsend duties crisis. The British response was largely a backing away. They pulled back from at least some of the activities that they had engaged in. In this case, Stamp Act gets repealed. Right? Spring of 1766, Parliament reverses itself, repeals the Stamp Act. And so this is a turning back. Right? Didn't repeal these other kinds of things, but the one act that was creating the most irritation, Parliament simply withdrew it. Right? Repealed it. So you have a British action, you have an American reaction, and then a British response. The same dynamic occurred a few years later. Right. So 1766 was a fairly calm year, fairly mild. In 1767, however, Parliament passed what were called the Townsend duties. Now, it's spelled with an SH, looks like Townshend, but it's pronounced with a hard S, Townsend duties, named after Charles Townsend. He was the Chancellor of the Exchequer in Britain. That's roughly equivalent to the Treasury Secretary in modern American government. They still have a Chancellor of the Exchequer in Britain as an office within government. The Townsend duties were aimed at solving that revenue problem, right? When the Stamp Act was withdrawn, the revenue problem, the debt problem, didn't go away. Right? So the Townsend duties were a second way, second act on the part of the British to solve a problem of theirs, the debt crisis. Right? and they put tax on certain imports into the colony. They identified five items, and they placed a surtax on those five items. So tax on imports. Same reaction, similar reaction, right? So this is a British action. And it fairly promptly produced an American reaction. Right? And so you get 1767 to about 1770. Now you have the Townsend Crisis, as it became known. More resistance. It's a British action, American reaction. And then, ultimately, there was a British response. Right? In the spring of 1770, Britain repealed all of the duties except on one product, tea. They left the tax on tea, but they repealed the rest of them. Right? So, repealed except on tea. And I'll use that to highlight, to emphasize the reality that while in both cases here the British response was to some fair degree a stepping back, Britain Parliament never stepped fully away from their authority. In both cases they attempted to assert their authority even while removing the chief irritant. Because when they repealed the Stamp Act in 66, they also passed the Declaratory Act. The Declaratory Act. And the Declaratory Act affirmed that Parliament had the right, and here was the phrase from the Declaratory Act, had the right to bind the colonies in all cases whatsoever. Bind the colonies in all cases whatsoever. All right, so that even while they're backing away by repealing the Stamp Act, they're asserting their authority in the Declaratory Act. Here, even while the Brits are backing away from the full effect of the Townsend duties, they leave one tax on tea, if for no other reason to emphasize that they have the authority to levy taxes. They're simply choosing not to levy taxes. In the meanwhile, in the middle of this, another element which indicated that Britain was not fully giving up raising a white flag was the insertion of British troops into Boston in 1768. We'll talk about that more in a bit, I hope. The insertion of British troops in Boston in 68. Right. So the dynamic then is one of British action, American reaction, British response, largely pulling back, but never fully simply acceding to the American position. Right. Now, when we next week, or later this week and next week, when we look at the later crises, we'll see the dynamic starts the same way. 73, you get the Tea Act. The American response, at least the most famous one, is the Boston Tea Party. In that case, however, Britain did not back down. Britain responds by passing a series of laws known as the Intolerable or the Coercive Acts. And it's really Britain's passage of those acts which heightened the resistance movement, pushed it on eventually towards revolution. So this cycle, British action, American reaction, British response, really occurs three times, at least three distinct times in the resistance or the run-up to the revolution. The first two times, it gets resolved by Britain largely backing away, but not fully. That third time, Britain didn't back away. In fact, we would say Britain doubled down on what they were doing in the coercive acts and the colonies got pushed on towards revolution. So, this dynamic of resistance emerges. No one knew it was going to emerge like this. Right? None of this is pre-planned. None of this is even expected. The Americans have no way of being certain that the Stamp Act is going to be repealed. They may have a little more hopes in the Townsend duties because of the Stamp Act, but they still don't know. This is still an unwritten story for them. All right. This dynamic maybe is the first thing that I want to spend now most of the rest of the class on, right? And that's really looking at the nature of the resistance. All right, so we looked at the background of the resistance. I've tried to illustrate the dynamic of resistance in the period between 65 and 70. Now the third thing I want to look at, want us to look at, is the nature of resistance. What was the resistance like? What kinds of things did they do? What kinds of things did they avoid? So that's what we want to turn to. Let me pause and see if anybody has questions about this dynamic of resistance. All right. Well, I'm going to argue that this dynamic is really can be the first aspect of the nature of the resistance. I'll tell you what I mean by that. Right, so if we move on. To the nature of resistance, that the dynamic that we've just looked at could be argued really is one of, not the most important, but simply one of the aspects of the nature of resistance, and that is that it was in response to a specific action. Again, going back to what I said a little while ago, it was not the resistance that emerged was not a response to just a kind of general feeling of discomfort, right? Or a general dis-ease with the way the colonies were going. Right? Today we have polls that come out every so often, and they'll ask a question. The question will be asked about Americans: how do they feel about the direction the country is headed? Right, and 53% will say one thing, and 38% will say something else. Right? There's no specific action that's involved in that poll question. It's just trying to gauge a kind of general sensibility. Right? We're not talking about general sensibilities in terms of the protests, the resistance that emerged. They emerged in response to specific actions, primarily the Stamp Act the first time around, primarily the Townsend duties the second time around, primarily the Tea Act the third time around. And if you want to think about a fourth cycle, it would be the Intolerable or the Coercive Acts. Right. We'll talk about all those later. Right. So this is where I want y'all to begin to contribute a bit more. I've spent most of the time talking, but I'll let you contribute. Our readings today dealt with descriptions of what went on during the Stamp Act resistance and the Townsend duties resistance. And what you should have picked up, what you should have learned, is that the resistance movements of 65 to 70 were multifaceted, that there were any number of kinds of resistance that occurred, elements of resistance that occurred in this time period. So I want us to begin to make a list of those and then talk about some of those in greater detail. So what were some of the kinds of resistance that came up? What did the colonists do? Yes, Stephen.
Boycotts.
Boycotts, what Stephen said. Now, I tell you, we'll make a list and we'll come back then through and talk about some in more detail. What other kinds of things? Megan?
Protests.
Anti-Stamp Act demonstrations.
Demonstrations. What's another kind of thing?
Burned a lot.
Okay, that's going to be a specific. Come back to that one. Burning effigies is a specific kind of public demonstration. Can you think of another category of resistance? Yeah, Joshua.
What about the coercion of magistrates in the colonies?
Yeah, coercion of magistrates. We'll talk about what kinds of coercion. But certainly coercion. Yes, Lindsay.
Better organization into specific groups, such as the Sons of Liberty.
Yeah. Organizations. And we'll come back and talk more about the Sons of Liberty there. Yes, Stephen.
The occasional riot.
The occasional riot. Riots. Or violence. Right, that's another thing that did occur. I think of any other kinds of resistance elements that you read about. Yes?
Prevention of specific appointments.
Okay. Probably falls under this coercion of magistrates that is preventing appointments. You're talking about the Stamp Act collectors, is that what
yeah.
you're right? Coercion of magistrates or potential magistrates in that case.
Tax collectors,
right. The Stamp Act collectors trying to prevent them from actually taking office or wanting to take office. Anything else that you remember? Any other kinds that you remember? Reading about. Well, a couple that you, and this is a pretty good list from what you read, a couple of other things, that one that you would have had to read between the lines to see, or better yet, you would have had to look at the footnotes to realize, is that there were any number of pamphlets or broadsides that were written and published in the colonies. Pamphlets ranged anywhere from 2 pages to 15, 20 pages, fairly brief, very inexpensive, right? Or broadsides, which are, we would call them posters, probably today, right? Just a single sheet could be put up on a wall of a building, and people could read that, right? So pamphlets and broadsides, publishing of these things in the colonies. Britain, for its own part, I should tell you, there are a lot of pamphlets published in Britain, in London at the time, arguing about the Stamp Act. One historian described this as a pamphlet war breaking out. And indeed, in some ways, that's an accurate description, that there was this ongoing to and froing of arguments, again, often in pamphlets, not in big books, but in pamphlets. Similar to pamphlets is the use of newspapers to argue for, or in some cases against, colonial resistance. Use of newspapers to do that. One of the elements that was not, again, you'd have to read between the lines some, but one of the things that was pursued was governmental action, specifically at the colonial level. Right. Having the colonial governments take some kind of action that would aid in resisting the implementation of these various acts. Perhaps the best known of them, but I don't believe was mentioned in the reading, is the passage in Virginia of a set of resolutions collectively known as the Virginia Resolves. And Patrick Henry, if you're familiar with him, was a key figure associated with the passage of the Virginia Resolves in response to the Stamp Act. These didn't have any binding force of law. They were simply resolutions, statements on the part of the Virginia government, colonial assembly, about the impropriety, the illegality, the lack of necessity for the Stamp Act. Right? So that was an example. One that was hinted at in the reading was the action of the New York legislature. The New York legislature actually moved to block the implementation of the Quartering Act in 65. So there were a couple of instances where inferior government action, government action of a lesser government than the imperial government, was sought and was used to try to put forward resistance. Okay, so boycotts, we'll come back. I want to use a different word because that's probably a better, more appropriate word. Public demonstrations, marches, rallies, those kinds of things. The writing and publishing of pamphlets and arguments and broadsides. Some riots, violence, getting a better organization, right? Getting organized to do this. The coercion of magistrates or people who might become magistrates. Use of newspapers to spread news about resistance or to spread arguments. And the effort to get governmental action. We had one more up here that we haven't talked about, was, again, talked about a little bit in the text. And that would be communication between various groups of resistors. Communication in between and coordination between groups of resistors. Remember, this is a very non-technological, by our standards, being non-technological age, before telegraph, telephone, before Twitter, before any of that stuff. And so groups in one colony or one town wouldn't immediately know what was going on somewhere else. Right? So today, if we wanted to find out what was going on in Timbuktu, we'd go on the internet, we'd Google Timbuktu, and we could find anything else we wanted to find out about. You'd find out there's actually a rebellion, kind of uprising going on in Timbuktu right now. Okay. Not so the case. They might get some from newspapers, but that was passive. You pretty much depended on when the newspaper got there and what was in the newspaper. They began actively organizing methods of communication between, we would probably call them resistance cells, right? In Boston, Newport, Providence, New York, Philadelphia, and down the coast. So that they could actually communicate amongst themselves. And notably, they did not rely just on the regular post. There was a regular post service. They actually formed, in effect, their own private courier service that could carry communication. Well, why did they do that? One reason they did that is it was faster. Right? Couriers, FedEx is faster than U.S. Post Office is, just the way it is. Right? It's faster if it's carrying one specific thing to one point rather than carrying all this stuff to another place. It's faster. Also, who controlled the British mail system in the colonies? The British, right? So if you're wanting to communicate resistance movement, sending it through the British mail, not a particularly good idea. In fact, there was an instance where a communique was intercepted as part of the regular mail. It caused some created some difficulties, and that said they said, okay, that's not a good idea. We just need to send these messages privately. Messages privately. Add all these things up. Tell me what this looks like. And don't say Stamp Act resistance, because yes, it looks like that. What does that look like? Think, open your mind up more broadly. What does it look like? Any ideas? Notions? I'd argue it looks like pretty much every protest in the history of American protests. Right. That, again, go back to what I said earlier. They didn't know it. They weren't thinking about it in this manner. But what they did was they created a template for protests, for American protests. Right. so that pretty much every group in American history since then has followed this template for the most part, maybe one or the other, but we still think in terms of economic boycotts. Manager of the Miami Marlins a week ago was reported of saying, this is Ozzie Guillen, reported of saying he loved Fidel Castro. That's not a smart thing to do in Miami that has a large Cuban expatriate population. Was the first thing the Cuban organization did down there? Let's boycott the Marlins. Nobody buy baseball tickets. Right? It's one of the first things that we do. Right? We still have public demonstrations. Right? Let's have a march. Let's have a rally. Let's get people together out in the streets. We write things, and we don't do so much pamphlets and broadsides. What do? Blogs, yes. Twitter, something, right? We have our own ways. Facebook, right? YouTube, certainly, right? So, again, we have similar kinds of things where you can put out very inexpensively sort of these blast protests arguing for something. Sometimes we have riots and violence, right? We certainly have had that. We love to form organizations, right? We've got to get organized here, so we create some group or some body. We try to put pressure on politicians, right? How do we put pressure on politicians? Yes, Stephen?
Lobbyists.
Lobbyists is a way of putting pressure. Yes?
We start petitions,
right? That's another way we put pressure on politicians, political figures. Yes, Stephen?
Mass writing of congressmen.
We write your congressman and organize some sort of pressure. Yes, Megan, back here.
Call them.
Call them. Get on the phone, right? And call them and tell them. And what do we tell them?
Do what I want you to do.
Or?
I'll vote you out.
I'll vote you out and get a lot of other people to vote you out. Okay, so coercion of magistrates that's very common now. We accept that to be a thing. Newspapers, again, can be used. Letters to the editor, sometimes editorials. We try to get governmental action done. If we can't get the main government to do it, we try to get lesser governments to take action. 2 years ago, the federal Congress passed the Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare. Right? Almost immediately, opponents to that action began trying to work through state legislatures and state attorneys general to resist that activity. That prompted eventually court cases that were argued in the Supreme Court just last week. It was 2 weeks ago. Time flies, right? So we try to get other governments, right? If the main government's doing something we don't like, try to get other governments. Or sometimes, if you look at American history, state governments would do something folks didn't like, and so let's try to get the federal government, right, to do something about this thing that the state government has done or the city government has done. So getting some other government involved to try to ameliorate the problem. And then certainly communication between groups is important. So if there's a group of students on Mercer's campus that are protesting something, they may begin to communicate with groups of students in Milledgeville or up in Athens or other kinds of similar kinds of groups. This is what we call trying to build a coalition, right? Get like-minded groups together, all on the same page, all essentially working for the same thing. Again, they didn't know it, but essentially they're laying out the template for the pattern of American protest at the beginning. Okay, so let's look at a little bit, some of these. We don't have time to look at all of them. Some of these in a bit more detail. Let's go back. Which came first? I remember the first element that came forward in this long list. Yeah, Stephen? No? I remember what came first? Well, I thought you might, because it was, in fact, that. Or if you want to combine it with this, some combination of that. So in August 1765, you had two, one on August 14th, one on August 26th, two public demonstrations slash riots. The first one was more of a demonstration. The second one was more of a riot. The first one burned the image of the potential Stamp Act collector in effigy. What does it mean to burn somebody in effigy? Kyle, you know?
Like a scarecrow dressed like them, or like a picture of them. It's not really them, but it's a physical representation.
Right, physical representation. We see that on TV from time to time. Someone being burned in effigy, right? So you a mannequin or a straw person or something with their clothes or face, right? Burned him in effigy, right? It's Andrew Oliver. What did Oliver do the next day? He resigned as Stamp Act collector. Right? This is this coercion of magistrates. Did they know he was going to resign? No. In fact, they weren't even really trying to get him to resign. But he did, and that was really what opened the avenue for colonial resistance. Right? Gave them the idea this could work. Right? That if we can get the Stamp Act collectors, not the stamp collectors, the Stamp Act collectors, if we could get them to all resign their posts, then the Stamp Act can't be collected, the tax can't be collected, and even if the law is still in place, no tax money will be collected. So it actually began, Stamp Act protest began that way, right, with these public demonstrations. Now, that second movement, the August 26th, was much more of a riot, much more violence involved. And the folks who tended to support August 14th fairly quickly clamped down on the August 26th business. In other words, very quickly, right from the beginning, the leaders of the resistance, the emerging leaders of the resistance movement, were trying to clamp down on violence. Right? They did not want the resistance movement to be associated with violence. Now, why didn't they turn to violence? Why didn't they say, you know, that's, you know, burning people's houses down, that's a pretty effective way of getting our message across. Why did they not want to do that? Yeah, Stephen?
British government has a wonderful habit of instituting martial law.
Yes, it does. Right, so today we often avoid violence because we don't want anyone to be harmed. We value each human life, and so we look at violence, we look at those kinds of things in a sort of generic, maybe even humanitarian way. But I think Stephen is right in suggesting that they avoided violence largely because they feared the response on the part of the British. That if the colonists turned violent in terms of their response, that the British were going to come down hard. And they had every reason to expect that that fact would happen, because that's what royal governments had tended to do, would probably do. Partly because violence is pushing you over into the arena of treason. And treason in a monarchy cannot be suitable, cannot be played with. And the British, of all people, should know that treason, right, the British monarch should know that treason is not something to be trifled with. It may have been close to over 125 years, but the memory of Charles I was still fairly prevalent in British monarchical minds in the 1760s. Charles had lost his head, literally, because of what was in effect treason. And the British crown did not want to go there again. All right. So, yes, it's more fear. Right? Their avoidance of violence is really more fear of the repercussions than it is. Thanks. Yes, Bonnie.
Couldn't you also argue that it would encroach on that person's liberty, like if you're
Okay, so your response is that by enacting violence, that they would encroach on that person's liberty, and since this whole thing was supposed to be about liberty, that would have gone against their
right.
kinds of things. I think that makes a certain amount of sense. I would agree with that. I'm probably inclined towards Stephen and fear rather than, and part of that is because I don't think they had as fully developed notions of personal liberty as we do. They are still in a fairly authoritarian world or mindset. But that makes a certain amount of sense. I think that's right. Okay. Well, so notice here, right, that public action, public demonstrations can be very useful, right? The lesson is that those things can be very useful if they are controlled, right? If they're limited, if they can avoid sort of mass violence, then that's a good thing. That rule, that lesson got reinforced in the other main sort of violent action in 1768 in Boston. There were riots, uprisings known as the Liberty Riots. Now, the Liberty Riots really had nothing to do with, as you read, nothing to do with the Townsend duties. They had to do back with those old issues of impressment and customs. The Liberty was a ship, that's why I underlined it, in Boston Harbor. And there was issues there in terms of whether the customs duties had been paid, issues of impressment as well. So there's riots. The resistance leaders, the more broad resistance, they were very quick to condemn the Liberty Riots, right? Because they knew that could produce trouble. And in fact, it did produce trouble. Remember, I've erased it long now, but you remember my talking about British troops being inserted into the colonies during this period. They came in October of 68. Why did they come? Not because of the Stamp Act protests, not because of the Townsend Duty protests. They came because of the Liberty Riots. So the Liberty Riots and the British response, the sending of the troops to Boston, reinforced this idea that violent public protest is not effective. In fact, it could be counterproductive. Okay. Let's. So it starts with that, and certainly that continued. There were any number of protests. This is the emergence of time where they used demonstration. They designated trees as Liberty trees. And so in Boston, you have this Liberty tree, and they hang candles in Liberty trees. Lots of burning in effigy, occasional tar and feathering, but for the most part, relatively peaceful public protests and demonstrations. All right. Let's talk about the coercion of magistrates, part of that as well. Let's talk about the boycotts. That's not exactly the right word, right? Boycott. There's another more precise word, and it's important to get it out early because what it will lead to. The more precise term is non-importation. Non-importation. So what's the difference between a boycott and a non-importation? Well, a boycott is essentially consumer-based. It relies on the consumer to enforce. So if we're going to boycott Walmart or boycott the Miami Marlins or whatever, that boycott really relies on individual consumers to not purchase or engage in that economic activity. Right? The non-importation, on the other hand, relies on the merchants. Right? This relies on the people or the consumer Non-importation really relied on the merchants. Right? So the agreement, the agreements that were in their non-importation agreements that emerged, the agreements were amongst merchants that they would not import goods from Britain. Not import goods. So they didn't aim it at the consumer level, their economic protests. They aimed it more at the merchant level. Now, in doing so, that was an advantage in doing it that way. Anybody figure out what's the advantage? Yeah, Joshua.
Well, it's the reason boycotts don't always work in America today. I mean, the consumer likes products, but if the merchants choose not to accept those products, to import those products, then the whims of the consumer as an economic body don't really affect the movement negatively.
Yeah. Okay. So if you didn't hear Joshua, what he said was that the consumer, I think you dissed the consumer, is often fickle, right? It's a lot larger number of people. Consumers like products. And if the product is there, they may well be inclined to purchase the product. Non-importation agreements relied on a lot fewer people. They're much easier to enforce. They relied on coercion to enforce these. It's difficult to coerce the entire populace. Right? Boycotts are difficult because often they need a certain amount of coercion to work or intimidation. And sometimes that can be done by peer pressure, could be done by people marching around, that can prevent you. But if you're going to have somebody in every little store marching around, that's a lot of organization. It was a lot easier simply to get the merchants to agree, we're just not going to import goods from Britain. Right? So in doing so, their hope is that they can put economic pressure on Britain, on the British merchants and manufacturers. And the British merchants and manufacturers will then put pressure on Parliament, and Parliament will repeal the Stamp Act, or later the Townsend duties. So that's the idea there, is to use economic pressure to bring to bear on governmental bodies. All right. Again, specifically in this case, non-importation, not so much boycotts. This is going to become important later, not so much today, but when we get to the Tea Act and the Coercive Acts, there's a certain element that's part of the Tea Act that is aimed at the merchants specifically, that it's important in that part of the story. So yeah, so getting the merchants together in these non-importation agreements. In this case of the Stamp Act, these came after the sort of public demonstrations. They began emerging in the late fall, October, November, December in 65. They increase in force through the winter and spring of 66. And generally, looking at why did the Stamp Act get repealed, historians have tended to put a fairly significant weight on the non-importation agreements. That Britain didn't really listen, they don't care what the Virginia Assembly's doing. The pamphlets and the broadsides, it's a bunch of chatter. Right? The violence is fairly limited, and they, it's hard to put down violence when you're 3,000 miles away. Right? There was a certain amount of things said in newspapers that nobody took seriously, Britain and otherwise. But when the British merchants and British manufacturers began to be pressed, and they began to put pressure on Parliament, that was when Parliament began to listen. Right? So the historians have tended to emphasize really this role in terms of resolving both the Stamp Act and the Townsend duties. One of the clues that might indicate that the colonists understood that too is when the Townsend duties were passed, the first thing that they went to, first thing they went to was non-importation agreements. The public protests, the other kinds of things, all that came, but that was almost the immediate reaction when the towns and duties came. We got to get those non-importation agreements going again. All right. Let's turn, we've got a few more minutes left, turn toward the Sons of Liberty. You read a fair bit about Sons of Liberty. Oop, that's my organization. How did the Sons of Liberty get started? Where did it come from? How did it get going?
It was it actually was born in the resistance movement. It emerged from a social club called the Loyal Nine, which was a group of respectable merchants and tradesmen who were involved in the burning of effigies in the August 14th.
Okay.
Riot.
Okay. So you've got this group, it's a kind of a social club, socio-political club, the Loyal Nine, that's involved in some of the public protests, that eventually begins to develop into, but that's a specific Boston thing. The Sons of Liberty began appearing across the colonies. So let's go back in the back to Austin.
It was kind of like a spontaneous thing. It was in a lot of different places. There was a movement in Savannah. There was a movement in parts of Charleston, New York, Boston. It started to get centered in New York, but really it started in a lot of different places. And what it did is it didn't necessarily bring up new ideas, but it rode the wave of popular resentment, and it just kind of focused and organized and put structure to that, and then it just kind of coalesced later, but originally it was just kind of spontaneous.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it, right? It was pretty spontaneous. There was no central plan. That's what I wrote on the board. There's no head honcho who was saying, okay, here's what we need to do. Let's start this thing called Sons of Liberty. No, it was spontaneous. We might call it, a grassroots organizational movement. So that in the Stamp Act, the protests well preceded the emergence of the Sons of Liberty. Well preceded by several months, the emergence of the Sons of Liberty as any sort of coherent organizational force in terms of the resistance movement. So this was not a case. The British often argued that the Sons of Liberty had foisted this on. The British didn't quite get the timing right in looking at this. They argued through much of the pre-revolutionary period that this was all just ginned up by these unhappy groups collectively known as the Sons of Liberty. British didn't get that right. In fact, the Sons of Liberty are trailing, or as Austin said, they are riding a wave, right? They're trying to provide certain organizational shape to a resistance movement that was well underway by the time. Sons of Liberty don't really emerge as a kind of force throughout the colonies till the winter time, 65, 66, very late fall into the winter of 65 and 66. So they did eventually, Sons of Liberty did eventually provide a certain amount of organizational coherence to the movement. But they in no way were the generators of the movement, nor were they the controllers of the movement. They were, in effect, attempting to provide some kind of organizational coherence to the movement. And often much of what they were doing, right, one of their chief efforts was this communication between the various towns, various places within the colonies to try to build this intercolonial coalition against the Stamp Act and then later the towns and duties. So that's sort of who the Stamp Act was, and I'm sorry, who the Sons of Liberty were, how they got started, and their role in the affair. All right. Let's try to sum up, try to draw all this together. The resistance movement, as it emerged, didn't emerge because it was the brainchild of some single person. It emerged in dozens of different spots across the colonies. It didn't emerge because of some fantastic organizational person that comes along and has some pyramid scheme, all right, to get people organized to do something. Instead, it was resistance movement was quite grassroots in its origination. It was at the start ill-organized, did not have any coherence to it. But it did prove in both of these cases, it proved to be very effective. Right? Proved to be very effective. That the multiplicity of kinds of protest in both cases, the case of the Stamp Act, the case of the Townsend Duties, was able to accomplish at least the chief goal of what they were trying to accomplish. Right? And that was the repeal of the act or acts that particularly annoyed them. So effective that certainly in the first case, in the Stamp Act, what happens to the resistance movement after the Stamp Act news? What happens to the Sons of Liberty after news appears in April 66?
It dissolves.
It dissolves. Right? All right. The resistance movement dissolves. It goes away. Certainly after the Stamp Act, it went away. The presumption was things were back to normal. Right? Britain's seen the proper way. And the movement just disappeared. A little bit less so after the Townsend Duties. Right? After that second round, the movement has a little more shape to it, a little more permanence to it. But even still, by 1770, no one is thinking about revolution. It's still very much in the mode of resistance. And the Americans still seem quite willing, right, to dissolve the resistance movement. Or maybe let me just finish with this. Right, one way that we know this was not a revolutionary movement at this point is their willingness to dissolve the resistance. That is, it was not an attempt to have ongoing agitation for the sake of agitation. Right? Sometimes we look at protest movements today, we think they're protesting because they want to protest. They've got nothing better to do, so they're just going to protest. Okay? The colonies were resisting and protesting not because they just had nothing better to do. They identified specific things they wanted pulled back. When those things largely got pulled back, they were largely willing to dissolve. I think that's, again, kind of further evidence that we really were, the United States, the colonies, really were in a resistance mode at this point, not in a revolutionary mode. On Thursday, if you've looked ahead, Meyer talks about the movement from resistance to revolution, right? There's a transition now. You go from 1770 forward to about 75. Now there's a transition from straight resistance on into revolutionary modes. And we'll take up that topic on Thursday. See you then.
Join us each Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern and Sundays at 1 p.m. for classroom lectures from across the country on different topics and eras of American history. Lectures in history are also available as podcasts. Visit our website at cspan.org/history/podcasts or download them from iTunes.